You're listening to the Cannabis Investing Network. Before we begin, a short disclaimer. The full disclaimer follows at the end of this episode. This podcast is a general communication and is being provided for entertainment and information purposes only. It is educational in nature and is not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment strategy, plan, feature, or other purpose. Please enjoy responsibly.
Hello, and welcome back to the Cannabis Investing Network. My name is Abby, and I am joined here with someone very special, a guy who you guys might know on Twitter, the one, the only, Mr. Todd Harrison. Todd, welcome to the show.
How are you, my friend? There are actually more Todd Harrisons, so I may not be the one and only.
Well, you're the one and only that matters for the Cannabis Network here. How's everything going, Todd?
It's doing all right. So what is this? It's now Monday, February 22nd, we're recording this. So things are going all right. Sort of the calm before the storm, I think.
Oh, yeah? All right. We'll see. We're already getting into it because that's already a very intriguing question, more or less. We've got a couple questions lined up here from just some of our listeners from the past and just something that Manish and myself wanted to ask you. But you got me all enticed there. The calm before the storm. What's the storm you're speaking of?
Well, I just think this is going to be a pretty significant year for U.S. cannabis in particular. And I think cannabis writ large. I think a lot of people think it's us versus them in terms of Canada, but there's going to be winners on both sides of the border and on borders across the world. It's an exciting time to be in this space. And I think there's going to be a migration. I think there's a fair amount of headline risk to the upside over the next month or so into earnings, and I think it's a sweet spot. I've been pretty bullish for a long time on this space, maybe too bullish here, but I think you got some room into the mid to the end of March to see a real move higher in U.S. operators.
There is so much packed in there. I can just ask you a million questions after hearing that. I took some notes down. So, okay, hold on. So, from what I know, you're obviously more bullish. Like, where are you most bullish on? Would you say Canada, the States? You also said other borders. Just kind of go into that a little bit.
I think the U.S. is where you have the most shock absorbers for the thesis. And I'm talking about New Jersey after a little drama, which I was born in Newark. I'm all about New Jersey. And I understand the drama. But coming through as it did and really putting the pressure on New York, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Connecticut, Maryland, Virginia, you can go right up and down the East Coast. It's 15th state, 1-5, 35 left, they're all coming. And that's sort of the fundamentals thesis for the U.S. operators is that continued state adoption. They all need it from COVID for the jobs and for the tax revenues. And certainly, you got those federal arbitrages, which I think are going to fall. But nonetheless, it's not about that as much as this is an economic driver, and it's also a social driver, which is equally powerful, which we'll get into a bit. But you got a lot going for it. You got state level adoption, and now with Schumer in there, with Booker in there, I think you're going to see a lot of change at the federal level. But the positioning, U.S. retail, U.S. institutions, they're all coming. Thankfully, there's more supply coming. We saw Parallel today. We saw Verano recently. We're going to see more and more good companies coming public, and that's going to help to, satiate some of that demand. But I think the demand is overwhelming versus the number of investable companies right now.
Absolutely. And I think you hit it on the head. And I think the quality and caliber of these private companies that are sort of going public now, it's quite a different story than what we saw back in 2017. I know a lot of people like to draw that parallel, but you just named two really good companies there. Verano, for example, what's one that, we've chatted about quite a bit on this podcast, and we know it quite well. What are your thoughts on Verano?
Yeah. We love, we want to be involved. At the time, and keep in mind that this funded before the Senate flipped blue, but nonetheless, we were looking at it, and we just haven't had a lot of this is just the honest part. We haven't had a lot of success with RTOs with some of these Canadian banks, and we chose to sit this one out and put that money to work. Thankfully, that money made money on its money. But I, you know, I think Verano was about 150% versus where it priced, or at least a double, 100% versus where it priced. So, you know, it's all relative. I think as you go forward, these new companies are going to give you an opportunity to, you know, to upgrade your portfolio. Verano, like some others, and not, you know, for nothing, but there's going to take some time to for the investing universe to get to know them, for them to demonstrate operational skills and stewards of capital and those things that the Green Thumbs and maybe some of these others, the TerrAscends and others, have demonstrated and earned their, you know, the trust of their investor base. So you know, this is all a process. You know, same thing with Parallel. You know, a lot of moving parts of some of these. Gage is coming. We can't wait. We own Gage, and we're excited about Gage. They, you know, they're doing a lot of things right. So, like I said, there's more on the horizon, and maybe some of what you're seeing today in the market is, you know, raising some capital for some of these other allocations. But keeping in mind that the big boys haven't, you know, pulled up a seat at the table yet, and Robinhood has yet to, you know, dip their arrows in the U.S. Space yet. I think it's there's a lot to look forward to in terms of, you know, going through 2021.
And you know what? I love what you just said there. The big boys haven't pulled up to the seat in the table. You're 100% right. And then that quote there, the Robinhooders haven't dipped their arrows yet. That's actually a hilarious quote. Definitely going to be using that forward. We got a little ahead of ourselves, so let's just backtrack over here. You know, let's just help our listeners understand who you are. So, what is CB1 Capital? Sort of, how did you get to where you are today? You know, you're quite active on Twitter. I follow your weeklies that you put out. I think you do a fantastic job on those. So yeah, so just tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us a little bit about CB1. Like, do you guys only invest in cannabis, or do you guys look at other areas as well? What's that look like?
Yeah, we're all about the, you know, we're all about the endocannabinoid system here. We're actually geared more toward 3.0, which is that efficacy-driven solution pathway, with the Dr. Ethan Russos, Dr. Julie Hollins, Dr. Jeffrey Chens of the world on our board. You know, joining the very capable Governor Gary Johnson and Lauren Gertner. But nonetheless, you know, we think that this that the plant is a treasure trove for efficacious agility, and that's that biotech pathway or 3.0 is going to really just blow the socks off of this whole thesis. Because, you know, think about what that does to the consumer curve, right? But just to back up for a second, so 30 years plus now, wow, I'm old. First with Morgan Stanley in '91, with the Black-Scholes model in the Wall Street Journal, and just didn't know my ass from my elbow, but worked hard and, you know, ended up, long story short, moving around the buy side when I was 26. I think I was promoted. I was the youngest VP at Morgan Stanley. And then I went to Galleon, ran derivatives, was told I didn't have what it takes to make partner, went to Kramer Berkowitz, became president. And I thought that that was what I wanted to do. And it, you know, ask the question some people ask, having fun versus being happy. It's a different conversation, but nonetheless, actually ask those questions right before the planes hit. And, you know, the reason I bring that up, the watching the people holding hands and jumping and running from the smoke is, that led me to Dr. Julie Holland, who is my Sherpa when it comes to cannabis and the science. And, you know, it was really, I didn't know what PTSD was, but she sort of walked me through, you know, why I shouldn't feel guilty about wanting to smoke for anxiety and sleep, and that was really it. You know, when you know, I just sort of went down that rabbit hole and studied the history and the 30,000 years and how this was weaponized as an immigration tool and the propaganda and the discrimination and the war on drugs and all that, you know, happy horse shit that we've been fed for the last 9 years. It just pissed me off. And, you know, went full tilt boogie into the space. And we have a wellness fund. It's a hedge fund structure, but we invest in global cannabis. And then we do some advisory work with companies in the space and some hedge funds in the space and trying to help educate this through the lens of wellness for what we see it as. So CB1, we advise, you know, as you know, MSOs, which is the US cannabis ETF. We advise some hedge funds. We advise some companies, private and public. Always disclose it, and always, you know, don't even look at the third rail, much less step next to it. So, you know, there are a lot of fail safes in place to make sure that not only, you know, that there's nothing that would even get a funny look if somebody took it the wrong way. So, you know, try 30 years of Wall Street, 30 plus on my side, and then our COO and general counsel is out of Brookfield Asset Management, where he was general counsel and COO. So we have that side of the house pretty covered, but it's an exciting time to be in the space.
No, for sure, for sure. And you know, I love the background that you just sort of gave. You know, a lot of people forget the medicinal aspect or the medicinal benefits of cannabis. And I think you hit it there right on the head. It's for PTSD, anxiety, for sleep, and then as well, sort of the history that cannabis has had. Basically the prohibition era, where we're now seeing the legalization sort of sweep through the US, has created a great investment opportunity. But you know, funds like yours, it's not just about the returns. You guys actually believe in the, like, you guys believe in the flower and you guys believe in the product, which is always good to see. So I mean, with that,
but it's not just CBD and THC. There's 100 cannabinoids. The minor cannabinoids is where the magic is. You know, mm-hmm. So it's like almost take, you know, I'm throwing the spaghetti against the wall for all these years self-medicating. Now we can actually pull the strands off the wall and start plugging them into receptors in specific parts of our body. It's a retrograde pathway to, you know, to homeostasis. I mean, it's really medicine disruption, right? It's going to disrupt Western medicine. This is a system that was first discovered in 91 or 92, thereabouts, was really not really research because of the federal illegality of cannabis. And, you know, and it's all been anecdotal, and it's all been despite having to search, you know, for bad things. They can only test cannabis for bad things for many, many years. And by accident, they found all of these anti-inflammatory properties and all of the efficacious, you know, pathways that this could potentially help solve for medical riddles. So it's exciting, and it's on the right side of history, and most people don't get it yet. And that's the part that I think a lot of people are losing as they think about pot stocks.
Right. And yes, and you're right. A lot of people do think of it as pot stocks, and they look at most of the recreational stuff. Would you say that's sort of your advantage or your fund's advantage? You guys sort of view cannabis in like a very unique perspective in relation to the rest of the market?
Well, I don't know if it's, you know, I would say it's a perspective. You know, timing is everything. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, I wrote about how cannabis was going to be a $1 trillion industry, you know, right before an 85% decline in global cannabis index on Bloomberg. So, you know, who was right, who was wrong? We lost a lot of money in 2018 and 2019. But, you know, we've, you know, stuck to our guns, and we've, you know, focused on the names that we think are going to be the, you know, the fang, and, you know, and certainly adapted that with the other side of the blue Senate and democratized some of that exposure. But this is all just beginning. I mean, this is, you know, this is still an under the radar asset class, and, you know, it's the institutional adoption. It's just the epic, and there's a lot of offsides that are still in front of us. So I think that, you know, if we got through, as we like to say, iron sharpens iron, if you know, operators and investors alike, if you got through 2018, 2019, and you're making money with an 80% effective tax rate, and not being able to bank and not being able to take credit cards and not being able to, you know, list in the US or raise capital through debt financing or any of that, and you're still mm-hmm. making money, think about what you're going to do with an even playing field in a friendly, you know, federal government. I mean, it's just, that's, we could live, and I say this all the time, but we could live 50 lives and not be as lucky as we are right now. But it's going to go fast. This cottage industry is going to turn into an industrial complex. We're going to blank, and if you're there, you made a lot of money, and it's going to go on for a while. But this is sort of, as we talked about a fair amount, the shooting fish in the barrel phase, the sweet spot. This is where we all feel smart before, you know, the market goes from tell me to show me, which is going to happen.
Right. Right. And this might be, I would usually say the $1 million question, but the $1 trillion question, only because you're here, is what's your timeline looking like for that? Like, I know there's no way for you to actually know, but, you know, when you guys are sitting down at CB1, you know, you guys are putting things together. How long do you think it is before the big boys show up to this table?
I think, look at the last 2 weeks of Green Thumb.
Yeah.
had somebody walk in by $100 million on the wire. You had Palestra, who is, oh, by the way, not that person, you know, file at 5.8%, I think it was. You have Bill Miller, you know, filing saying this is a vastly undervalued stock. And that's just, you know, that was the fourth quarter of 2020. Like, wait till we see what was happening after the Senate flipped, because that's when all the volume came in. So I can't wait to see who these big boys are. But I'm telling you, there's not enough to go around. Wait till these things get indexed. You know, like, is that, you know, like, and people always used to say to us, why are you focused on the U.S., on the listed names? Why are you focused on the publicly traded securities? Or, you know, isn't the real money on the privates? And I'm like, yes, but when this becomes, when if you go from 1.0, which was Canadian cultivation, to 2.0, which is U.S. CPG, before 3.0, which is efficacy-driven solutions, right, that denial to migration to panic, that move from, you know, this causes cancer, this is a vice, to, you know, that cusp, that migration becomes institutional adoption. And as that starts to take root, and the consumer curve starts to take root, and you can access these investments, all of a sudden, you're going to start to see different indications come through the clinical pipe. And it's not going to be any one time. It's going to be this point of recognition when there's this efficacious agility and people say, holy fuck, this isn't going to cause cancer. This is going to help to solve for it. Like, right, all of those late stage adopters are going to come piling in. And that's when you want to probably, you know.
Well, you want to be positioned ahead of that, right?
Two-sided buck, we'll say. You know, there'll be plenty of two-sided arm. But right now, where we are, like, we don't have any shorts in cannabis right now. Like, we have no interest. Like, we, you know, we have some longs in Canada, and like, we got shorts of MJ for a trade, you know, last week. I think it was last week, but it was like the best of times, the worst of times, get the f*** out. Because, like, with and for our money, we want to be in this, you know, we want to sit on the inside of this adoptive curve as the Wall Streetification takes root.
Gotcha. And so that's a very that's a very interesting outlook. So, I mean, like, just given your background and just given all the comments you just made right there, how would you say institutions view the current industry right now as a whole? Like, are they looking at this being like, okay, you know, I see the light at the end of the tunnel that Todd is preaching, or are they looking at it more from like a banking or like a buy side perspective, looking at valuations and being like, okay, these valuations are a little bit high, these can come down? I mean, like on the public market,
where you stand is a function of where you sit in terms of analyst projections. None of the state, I mean, you got 15 states, you know, that they're building into numbers. They don't have the rest of the Republic in there, and they certainly don't have, you know, I think the knock-on effect you're going to get when this becomes accessible to the Robin Hood world of the world. And I'm doing U.S. retail and U.S. institutions, right? I mean, there's a lot of hedge funds out there. You're not going to find, like, and to be clear, like, we were jumping up and down last year, you know, this saying growth and value, growth and value, getting growth and value. That's not the case anymore. Like, I hate to,
okay.
Like, that narrative has now changed. Like, it's not growth at value. It's growth at reasonable. And by it's growth at value if you look forward at all the states that are coming. But versus the, you know, total addressable market for 2022, it's fairly valued. But still, you know, not the right owners, right? So that positioning part of it really comes into play. And you don't have any of that. Like, you think about it. I think it was Ben Kovler at Green Thumb who said, if, you know, safe banking comes through, which it will, and we can refinance it, you know, in the high single digits, you know, it's like $100 million dropping to our balance sheet. Another $100 million. You know, they just had somebody give them $100 million. So, you know what I'm saying? Like, this is an industry that 12 months ago had real existential risk. Like, it could have gone either way. And that was before the pandemic. So, like, we've talked about, I'm not going to sort of repeat myself, but there was a slow-moving perfect storm that now brings us to this place. And remember, you know, it's February 22nd. You know, that you're talking, what, 6 weeks? Mm-hmm. So 6-7 weeks since the Senate flipped blue?
Yeah.
You know, they're just fueling the birds, man. They're coming.
Oh, and I'm excited, and I think we're very well positioned, and it's something that's got me excited. One thing I guess I want to ask you about, sort of to continue on this, is that We hear about uplisting all the time. And for those of you who don't know, uplisting basically means a lot of these companies are trading on the CSE. They're going to go to big board exchanges like the NASDAQ or the NYSE once the Safe Banking Act sort of comes through. But so, Todd, for you, like, how big of an impact do you think uplisting will be? Not necessarily just for institutional capital, but just for all the privates that you mentioned, and just for the sector as a whole.
It's seismic. It's seismic. I mean,
yeah,
and,
eh?
You know, and I'm just saying because, you know, I've been on the street for 30 years. I mean, traders need liquidity. They need to check certain boxes for them to play, right? Like mm-hmm. everybody has a boss.
yeah.
And there's been some pioneers, and we talked to them on the buy side who, you know, said, you know what, you know, I've been buying this in my PA for long enough. Like, it's time. And more of them are coming. But the ability to sort of put this, you know, like I said, it's going to be a really good thing in that presumably by the time that we're uplisting, and I'm looking at, let me look at the US kind so we could talk apples to apples. But by the time we uplist, you're probably talking about Curis pushing 50 maybe, Green Thumb probably pushing 75, you know, Julie's par plus. You know, I mean, TerrAscend's, you know, 35, 40. I mean, like, you're talking about a re-rating. And that's, you know, it's going to be a beautiful thing if you're sort of long and kind of strong until then. But then it gets, you know, there's a lot less cushion in your approach, right? Like, you better not only beat numbers, but you better, you know, you better continue to find acquisitions that are accretive and set up partnerships that are, it's going to set, like I said, it's going to separate the wheat from the chaff. It's going to make, it's going to create a two-sided market. And that's where a lot of alpha is going to be created. Right now, you know, we're not short cannabis in the US. You know,
right.
You know, we've shorted some Canada, but not the US kind, because if what we see is going to happen, if we're right about what's going to happen, it's just not worth it yet. Right. Like, why get involved? Like the U.S. has a whole adoption curve in front of it. So let the big boys work for us.
That makes sense. And, you know, I think one of your tweets you put out a little while ago, it was, I can't remember exactly when, but it was a very famous one. It says, don't sell the winners, come back in a few years. Right. Could you sort of explain, like, I know we just talked about this uplisting. We just talked about the names that you mentioned and how you guys are long the U.S. And where you see a lot of growth. Like, can you just explain a little bit, like, what did you mean by that? Like, don't sell the winners, come back in a few years.
Yeah, that was July 11th. And you know how I know that? Because I just looked. I have it taped on my monitor. it's a reminder that if you believe in the fangification, and obviously that was before the election, and again, we sort of democratized that exposure a bit once the Democrats took the Senate. But the idea is that, you know, you just went through that 2-year Andy Dufresne river shit backstroke to get to this place. Hold on to them. Let the market, you know, let them understand, let them equaling, you know, institutions and retail investors, let them understand what is happening here. And let these stocks work for us. Like, I think the Reddit crowd would call those diamond hands, but, you know, I call it just trying not to be a trader and trying to be more of an investor. And again, it goes back to that short-term voting machine, long-term weighing machine concept. But the idea is over the long term, like, I don't want to think about, for instance, TerrAscend. Like, we tweeted back in January of 2020 that we like what Jason Wild's doing. We're starting a position. I mean, that stock was under $3.
Right.
Now on the U.S. kind, it's pushing 16. I don't know. Like, it sort of means hold on to the winners. And don't outtrade yourself. And as somebody who cut his teeth as a trader, it was more a reminder to myself just to, you know, looser grips, let, you know, understand where we are in the cycle, understand these offsides from a positioning standpoint. And there's not that many TerrAscends out there. It's a commodity right now.
Mm-hmm. And so it seems like now you'd view yourself more as an investor in cannabis, as like a trader in cannabis. Quick, just quick question for you. Like, how often are you entering and exiting positions? Like, how often are you guys buying, selling? Are you guys clipping profits like quarterly, or is this something where, you know, you're like, okay, look, we like TerrAscend, we're gonna enter, and then, you know, it starts doing well and you guys keep buying more as opposed to taking it off the table?
It really depends. You know, it depends. Like, for instance, Village Farms is a big position. It was $5 in November. We were jumping up and down. It was at 22 last week. Like, it wasn't the same size position. We harvested a lot of those gains.
Right.
We re-entered it into 15 and then sold some back out. You know, like, we trade around the volatility, but, you know, we want to hold on to the cores. And unless it re-rates the way Village did so quickly, I mean, this was, you're talking about what, 400% and, you know, in a couple of months, it was like, okay, thank you. We're going to roll our calls up, you know, and we're happy to sort of continue. And we did a lot of that. Like, people think we hate on Canada. We made a lot of money in Canada, rolling up calls. You know, I remember the Village December 6 calls for 35 cents. Those were good buys, right? I mean, the 6th, not the 16th. So there's a lot of money to be made, but we want to trade Canada, you know, and really try to invest and hold on to the U.S. kind. Because if what we think is right, you know, this is going to become a much harder trade later this year.
Okay. And you use the term there, your cores. Would you call your cores the winners? And if so, like, what names do you consider to sort of be in that realm?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to go through my book, but certainly
that's fine. Yeah,
I've been pretty vocal. I think there's, you know, there's a handful of names that are mispriced. Some of them not as much as they were. I think much like we saw in Canada, where you had Canopy, Aphria, Aurora, and MedRelief back in the day. You know, you're going to have that sort of fang, right? And I think it's going to be the Green Thumbs, the Curas, the Crescos. And the true leaves, and I put TerrAscend in there because I think TerrAscend's a cut above. But then, you know, you have Verano, and you have, you know, Parallel, and you have, you know, Columbia Care, who I think is just completely mispriced, and we advise them and have a position in all these names. We have positions in, but certainly I think, you know, Choo Choo, as we call Columbia Care, is just, it's off its market when you look at it at its footprint versus some of these other guys. So there's a bunch of them. Forefront, another client of ours, but certainly, things been a monster, right? And now there's also, you know, I think Howard at Hedgeye, I was listening to his piece today. He said they're in a running for a New Jersey license. Like, you know, hello. You know, I don't know anything from that, but certainly, you know, Howard seems to be speculating. My point is, there's a lot of good news, I think, that's not sort of priced in yet. And I think there's a lot of people who are sort of doing with the cannabis space what I'm sort of doing with Verano right now. Like, I really hope it pulls back so I can buy some.
Right. Okay. So you mentioned that there's a lot of good news that's sort of not being priced in right now. How do you, given your background, your Wall Street background, sort of quantify that? Like, are you looking at forward-looking multiples? Are you looking at earnings? Or are you just sort of looking more at, like, the big picture? Like, how would you sit down, and when you guys are meeting together, how would you guys be like, okay, like, look, we like this story. These are the reasons why.
I think there's four legs under the table. There's fundamentals, there's technicals, there's structural, and there's psychology. And if you get those four legs under the table, you're in good shape. And I think fundamentals we talked about, right? And maybe not as compelling as they once were, but certainly growth at reasonable and a total adjustable market that will continue to expand. That's the fundamental story. And I think it's a great one. You know, technicals, these things are breaking out. Most of them have pennant formations right now, but, you know, they're far away from all-time highs and blue skies, you know, across the board. Whether it's MSOs or Trulieve or Green Thumb or Cura or any of these guys. Cresco's a bit different, but that's basing over an all-time high, equally powerful chart. So technicals, volumes, getting volume dried up last week on the pullback. Every time these space upticks, you see volume coming in, technicals are powerful. Structural, we talked about the offsides, the onboarding of retail and the institutions, and then psychology. I mean, people are going to understand that this is a secular growth story. As my friend Ben Cove likes to say, this is the great American growth story. And just, you know, I think when the Robin Hooders and some of these other guys on Wall Street best understand that you can really take it to the man by stepping in front of their ability to buy these names,
yeah,
them lift you as opposed to trying to jam Sundial, which is just not going to happen over the long run, I don't think. You know, God bless it if it does. But if I'm Sundial, I'm issuing as much stock as I can, as much, you know, for as long as I can until I get my balance sheet better. I go with the companies that have better balance sheets. You know, this is sort of the MSO gang, and I think it's been bastardized, and people say, oh, it's a cult and they're blinded. No, we're just trying to educate people that if you're going to, you know, put your money to work, let the money work for you, and you have a better shot of doing that on the U.S. side of the border.
Which makes sense. And yeah, do you want to touch on, I know before this, you and I were just chatting a little bit about the MSO gang and sort of how it is sort of being perceived as some sort of cult. And, you know, I think you did a good job, but it's always good to remind people sort of, you know, how did the MSO gang start and sort of, you know, where is it today, more or less, or why is it where it is today?
Yeah, no, I mean, listen, it started, technically it started in the end of last year. A gentleman on Twitter started it. I did not. I mentioned it on Fox, and next thing you know, I have my face on Marlon Brando's face, which is scared the crap out of my daughter. But nonetheless, daddy, why are you so old, daddy? Oh, God. But, you know, I think, you know, like in anything in today's day and age, people feel the need to polarize a narrative, and it has to be sort of, the greatest day ever, the worst day imaginable, and you're either on fire or you're not, or you're either this or you're that. You know, I got involved in this because I really felt like it was important to communicate the opportunity on the U.S. side of the equation. And just so that people are aware, I've been writing online for over 20 years. I've never given anybody advice because I don't know their time horizon and risk profile. And certainly I'd like to point out the risks. But, you know, when you turn on cannabis and it's Canadian tickers all the time, enough's enough. And when you go on CNBC and you have a position of influence, you have a responsibility to tell the right story, or at least tell both sides of the story. And there certainly have been some on CNBC who have carried that torch, and I point to Tim Seymour and Carl Quintanilla to a degree, but that's about it. It's leading the sheep to slaughter when you can be leading the lambs to honey. I don't know what I was I should probably stop drinking wine at this point of the podcast.
No, I think you're 100% right. You know, there's been times where I've turned on CNBC or even BNN up here in Canada, and, you know, they'll have an interview with Kim Rivers, and she's the CEO of Trulieve and a great Florida operator down there. And the tickers next to her will be Aurora, Canopy, and Aphria. And to me, it's like it makes absolutely no sense. So I fully understand where you guys are coming from. Having said that, though, going from there, though, lately, the valuation on the big four MSOs has skyrocketed. I mean, you know, everything's sort of gone up, but the big four MSOs seem to have done significantly better than almost everybody else in the U.S. cannabis market, more or less.
No, that's not true, though. That's not entirely true. The back half of that MSO totem pole has actually outperformed the big four. Or five, and that goes back to that whole risk reward thing, that these were left for dead a year ago, and now they're actually viable, probably roll-up candidates, but nonetheless, you know, not dead money. So if you look at sort of the returns, I think you're getting paid for that back half of the totem pole, which continues to re-rate. But I think that the institutional money will drive that fang, if you will, going forward. Mm-hmm. So. I apologize. I think it's important to get it right.
No. And you know what? This is interesting, because one of my actual favorite companies that not a lot of people talk about, we talk about it quite a bit here, is Ayr Strategies. And Ayr Strategies is not a big four MSO, but they are one that's sort of, you know, creeping up there with the rest. And I think they're sort of in the latter half. Like, are there any others that sort of come to mind for you?
No, I mean, listen, I think if Ayr has that execution risk, it's a big position for us. I see what you see. I don't think that the analysts are, you know, in the habit of, of looking at pro forma multiples, you know, integration risk is integration risk. And it's not dissimilar, you know, from, I mean, it is dissimilar, but not entirely dissimilar from, you know, some of the other companies that are going to need to demonstrate the ability to, you know, steward capital and the integration risk. This is phase two, the show me, right? Show me that you can integrate these assets. Show me that you can optimize LHS. Show me that you can, you know, that six and a half times 2022 EBITDA is, you know, is a real metric. Because if it is, this thing should probably double or triple by year end. It's $100 if they can execute, you know, and that's, you know, the market's going to need to see that before, before it rewards them that, that multiple or that they should get. But I mean, we certainly have, you know, we have a big position in there. We think that it's one of those still under the radar. If they can execute, they'll be a 1A for sure.
And I agree with you. That's awesome. That's actually a really, it's a much better answer than I was expecting. And so just sort of to touch on that integration risk, right? There's a lot of M&A activity that's happening, and a lot of people are just sort of taking it at press release level or headline level, right? They're reading, they're reading, for example, Air buying LHS, and they're just assuming that everything sort of gets integrated. How do you guys factor, how do you guys quantify that integration risk? Because, you know, going back to those four pillars that you talked about, I mean, it's obviously not a technical.
It's a structural, but I mean, it's, you know, listen, if there wasn't risk, it would be called winning, right? Not investing. There has to be risk somewhere along the value chain to, you know, for there to be that disconnect between perception and reality. And listen, you know, just so it's said, you know, I was also very bullish on Ianthus, saying this is growth at distressed. It was distressed for a reason, right? And there were others, right? So there are going to be those types of value traps out there, right? So the answer to your question is you right size your risk. You know, this happens to be a big position for us on a relative basis, but if it went to zero tomorrow, we'd still, I mean, presumably, all else being equal, I'll be powering up to go to work the next day, right? So it's about running a proper portfolio, the integration risk. I mean, I think the MSOS, I wrote this on Twitter, so I don't know when this will post, but I think it's got this sweet spot into earnings. New Jersey's out of the way now. You have very likely positive upside risk, headline risk between now and the next, you know, 4 weeks. I think you scored higher. Every chart has a pennant. If the market falls apart, you know, I guess you throw that asterisk up there and say, hey, the market crashed, you know. But I'm not really, you know, looking for an excuse as much as say, this is what I think. It may be right, it may be wrong, but it's honest. And that's how we're positioned. We're to the tits in cannabis right now.
Right. And so when you guys are, you did mention look at the portfolio as a whole and not look at each individual position, right? So mitigate your portfolio, mitigate your risk by sort of diversifying your holdings. It's difficult. So for example, myself, I would say 95% of my portfolio is in cannabis. And then the other five is in other high risk asset classes.
And how old are you?
I'm 30 or 32. Sorry. Wow. Forgot my age. That's how old I am.
You're 20 years younger than me. So my point is, the younger you are, especially given what we're seeing in cannabis, anybody who's your age or younger, I'm 100% in and 52. Yeah. I'm Zach Mayo, man. I got no place left to go. This doesn't work. You know, I'm bartending, but the going to work because this is happening. So, you know, the younger you are, I don't think there's anything wrong with being exposed to this. I don't have anything in crypto, I don't know from that. You know, I just don't know from that. So I'm going to focus on what I know and try to stretch every dollar I can across cannabis.
Right. And so how do you mitigate risk in cannabis? I know we talked about, I would lump, you know, the U.S. as obviously one, maybe it doesn't really move in unison, but the correlation between what happens in California versus in the East is quite different. But in the beginning, you also we talked about Canada, and you also talked about other borders. I mean, when you're looking at the whole portfolio from a geographical perspective, like, is that how you're mitigating risk?
Well, no. I mean, we rank our portfolio anywhere from 0.5% to, right now 12% for a particular name. But, at any given time, if we get the rally we're looking for into earnings, we'll take those 12s to 10s, we'll take those 10s to 8s. We'll raise some cash, we'll reallocate it. There's plenty of investment opportunities, but it's just taking some off the top and rotating it into some of these new opportunities as they come in. So that's active management. That happens every day. Well, with this type of volatility, I mean, we can, to a degree, trade around these positions because they're moving 10, 12, 14%. So, we try to leave, we've been deferring to the buy side, meaning we're more likely to overcompensate buying some of these names as opposed to selling them. But give me if things shift in the book, if those four pillars start to look different, if something happens to change our views, then we will, we'll raise more money. But I don't see anything right now other than the broader market, and I think that's okay.
Okay. That's very interesting. Because here's another tweet that you had. You mentioned something about barbarians at the gates, right? That was, I can't remember exactly what when you tweeted about it, but was that sort of like were you guys getting skittish of what was going on? Because I've read Barbarians at the Gates, the Arjun Abisko book, like way back when. What did you mean by that? Like the barbarians are at the gates.
Well, that was in August, and the whole premise of that was talking about how Wasatch and how Putnam had slipped through, and Putnam had just registered as a holder for Forefront, and
Oh,
Wasatch
okay.
had just slipped through as a holder of Cresco and Green Thumb, and that's a pretty big deal for those of us who obsess over these types of things. This was again that posted in August. So, to give you a sense of where we were in August, MSOs wasn't yet launched because that launched in September. And Green Thumb, let me just look it, was trading around $18 as opposed to 48, 50 on the Canadian kind, or if we're looking at on the U.S. kind. In August, you could say Green Thumb was trading at about $13.50 versus a $35 now. So this is about the change in ownership, that transfer of ownership, and these institutional holders slipping through. And again, we've seen Bill Miller, we've seen a number of people take big chunks of Green Thumb. I think I'm aller I think I have some sort of allergy. I can't stop buying the stock at 45 today. I just keep buying it. And I just think it's probably best in breed or damn close.
Okay. So it was a very specific. Okay, gotcha. That explains it quite well. I thought maybe you were talking about it from like a risk perspective, but I guess it was very specific to that, to those two transactions there.
When you do these interviews, you should probably read it first.
Yeah, you're right. I appreciate that. On that note, MSOS, right? That's been fantastic. That ETF has been phenomenal for attracting capital for just capital flow into the industry. Just a quick question for you on MSOS, and I know you're an advisor to them, but how do they decide what to buy and more importantly, when to buy it?
You would have to ask Dan that. Dan's the portfolio manager. I mean, we offer them, we advise them, and it's pretty much, a staid process in that we run data in-house that we share with them. There are certain qualitative questions that we can answer, but by and large, we talk about what we're seeing, who, what in the space we think is working and how necessarily we think you should position for that. But we don't know what they're going to buy or when they're going to buy it. And certainly because of the forward return swap that's involved, it's from a timing standpoint, that's really on their side of the ledger, right? So it's not actually them who is turning around and buying the underlying, it's their counterparty. So it's pretty involved. And like I said, there's a fair amount of fail safes. But really, you know, that's just part of what we're doing with them. The other side is education, working with them to helping to educate the investing universe about the different sides of cannabis and the different opportunities and different risk factors. And also on the philanthropy side, trying to help to pay it forward and to set protocols in place so that as the industry does better, we can continue to do well by doing good and paying it forward. So all of those things, you know, have been part of it. But in terms of the specific reasoning for why they would buy something, you would have to ask Dan, who's the portfolio manager.
Okay, perfect. No, that's fair enough. And I think, you know, we're sort of coming to the end of the interview over here, Todd. So I really appreciate you taking the time to sort of sit down with me, answer some questions. I do have sort of, I know we've sort of talked about this quite extensively, but I do sort of have like one question for you. I mean, with all the stuff that's sort of happening in the cannabis space, all these catalysts, everything that's happening sort of in the broader market, I mean, what are your thoughts in terms of just how an average investor should sort of position themselves going forward? I know we talked extensively about MSOs. We talked about your views here on in Canada. Outside, you know, maybe let me reword that question. Outside of the big four MSOs, are there any stories that have you exciting? So sort of themes that you feel aren't really getting recognized. I know you mentioned 3.0. That's one of the first times that I'm really hearing somebody really with as much passion speak about 3.0. So I'll leave that question to you.
No, I mean, I think 3.0 is a catch me out. It's gonna dwarf, expectations. And most people don't think it's a thing yet. When there's about, I don't know, baker's dozen of names there. I've written about some of them on Substack. They're all right size. You're talking about 0.5% to 1% if you're feeling brave. And these names, as you know, GW was our baby. Yeah. Got taken out for less than half of what it was worth. But you know, you don't look, you know, as my grandfather said, if the dealer puts chips in front of you, you take it. So on we go. But I think we're excited about Gage. You know, again, we have a fairly big position in that already. It hasn't come public yet, but we have a fairly big position for a reason. Parallel is interesting. We want to do a little bit more work. Want to get involved in Verano at the right price, but really, you know, we've built a relationship with a lot of these management teams, whether that's, you know, the Bens or the Borises or the Charlies or the Jasons or the Kims and, you know, Nick, and you can go down the line. And I think, you know, they've built this trust. And I think as long as they can execute, they'll continue to be in the driver's seat. Less concerned about sort of the relative alpha in Canada, you know, certainly not bearish per se, but don't really want to put my money or my clients' money in Canada right now, when I think the U.S. is just going to, you know, provide generational opportunities. So that's about as honest as I can be. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you guys, certainly. You know, let's do it again.
For sure. Absolutely. We loved having you on here. You know, for any of our listeners, if you guys have any questions for Todd Harrison, feel free to tweet him or feel free to email us at cinpodcast@gmail.com, and we will be sure to get them out to Todd. And Todd, thanks again so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Awesome. Thanks, Todd.
This podcast is a general communication and entertainment being provided for informational purposes only. It is educational in nature and not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment product, strategy, plan, feature, or other purposes. Any examples used in this podcast are generic, hypothetical, and for entertainment purposes only. None of Cannabis Investing Network or its affiliates are suggesting that the listener or any other person take a specific course of action or any action at all. Communications such as this are not impartial and are provided in connection with advertising and marketing of products and services. Prior to making any investment or financial decisions, an investor should seek individualized advice from a personal financial, legal, tax, and other professional advisor that take into account all of the particular facts and circumstances for an investor's own situation. By listening to this communication, you agree with the intended purpose described earlier. Opinions and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions constitute our judgment and are subject to change without notice. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors.